Hi, this is Danielle from the Jaws Curator, and this is episode 122 of Art for Your Ear. This episode, like all the others, is supported by Saatchi Art, the world's largest curated online gallery offering original art by independent artists from around the world. Visit them and their lineup of artists at saatchiart.com or pop over to limited.saatchiart.com to see all of their brand new limited edition prints that are available. So today I am talking to an artist that I just wrote about a few weeks ago, British painter Lisa Wright. So a few hours after the post went up, I got a message from Charlotte Keats, a fabulous artist who I interviewed back on episode 107. It turns out that Lisa was her teacher at university. How could I resist that small world situation? I couldn't. So Lisa is on the podcast today. It is a tiny bit echoey on her end, but that's only because she's sitting in her lovely Cornwall studio. That is an excellent reason for an echo. All right, answers to my questions from Lisa Wright in Cornwall. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Danielle.
I'm so excited to talk to you. I just wrote about you the other day.
Oh.
And then I found out that you used to teach Charlotte Keats.
I did.
And so when I wrote about you, she messaged me and said, oh my gosh, she was one of my old teachers. You have to have her on the podcast. And so here we are.
Well, thank you, Charlotte. one of my star pupils.
Oh, that's so great. And I want to, we're going to get to that and talk about that. But I want to hear about where you grew up as a kid and were you super artsy back then?
I was, actually. I suppose I've always thought that I would do something creative. I think I've always sort of been making things and drawing and very, very encouraged to do so, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very good.
Are your parents artistic or are they just very supportive of you?
Very supportive. My mother, actually, she definitely has a creative leaning and has always made things and made clothing and all sorts of things in terms of sewing and not so much in terms of painting or drawing. But so I suppose I did have that kind of influence, and they definitely both encouraged me to kind of go on this journey. Mm. And I think that has really definitely helped in terms of having their support. So,
Did you sew when you were young?
I did. Yeah. I did, actually. Yes.
Me too.
I definitely, it's interesting because I am, as things progress, all those kind of dots join up, don't they? And you suddenly sort of think, oh, actually, that is maybe playing its part.
Well, I was wondering with all of the lacy type things that are showing up in your work now, if you were...
I know. It's strange, isn't it? The layers of all those experiences sort of percolate up and surface in different ways at different times in your life as well, different times of your creative journey.
I know. I love that too. My mom is a painter, but she also sewed everything because we were super poor. My dad was doing his PhD when I was a baby and they had no money, so my mom sewed everything. There's actually a wonderful photo of my mom and I when I was about 1.5 wearing matching mushroom print dresses.
Oh, I think I have a similar photograph.
I bet you do.
Yep.
I know, when you said I was like...
I think it was one of those, oh, these curtains look interesting. Should we make outfits? And actually, I rather wish I still had some of those fabulous outfits.
Oh, I know. That's so funny. Like, that's what it looks like. It looks like she took down... It's like Sound of Music. Like, she took down the curtains and made these mushroom dresses. Anyway, so funny. But I grew up with the sewing machine around and, ribbons. And she had one of the drawers that had all the edgings and the ribbons and whatever. And I just remember being like, ooh, hoo, hoo, hoo.
So, well, I still feel like that when I go into a sort of haberdashery shop or, I still have kind of, a little bit of excitement seeing all of those colors and textures.
Yeah,
wonderful.
Me too. I wonder if that's an artist thing. I should start asking people about that because,
definitely.
Yeah, I know. And then so did you go to art school right out of high school or did you take a break?
I did. I didn't take a break. I was very clear from a very early age that this was the path that I wanted to take, and was very fortunate to have incredibly supportive art teachers, and you know, from an early stage, saying I think, you know, and telling my parents that they you know, should encourage me and support that journey, and just very fortunate to have really wonderful teachers and and amazing sort of guidance along the way. Very inspiring.
Did you go in for painting?
So I initially, for my undergraduate, I had done a foundation course and really enjoyed all sorts of aspects of art practice. And I think I decided to apply for an illustration course because I actually thought I ought to do something that might lead to some kind of job. And very, very quickly, I realized that this really wasn't for me. I was making too much mess. I was standing up working, you know, drawing on the wall, or drawing on paper, stuck on the walls, you know, and everybody else was sat at their desks working very neatly. And I just thought, this really isn't for me. And had a moment where I just thought, I have to change. And that was literally after about 3 or 4 weeks. Uh-huh. So I switched to the fine art course, which they didn't have any room in painting. So they said that I could go into printmaking, but still sort of utilize all the tutors and all the kind of materials and all the everything that was set up for the fine art students in painting. So in a sense, I got the best of both worlds. I got access to a broader range of tutors and materials. So it was a wonderful undergrad course, really good.
Was that at the Royal College of Art? Is that where you were?
No, I went, that was at Maidstone. It was then called Maidstone College of Art. This is many years ago. And I applied to go to the Royal Academy of Art, where I eventually went.
Oh, okay.
Which was then an extraordinary sort of 3-year postgraduate course. Still the only 3-year postgraduate course, I think, in the UK.
Wow.
And I did have a year break. Or maybe two, was it? I can't remember, in between, between going, doing my undergrad and doing my postgrad. Mm. When I was doing storyboards and working for a production company at that point. So I was
in your gap?
To make money.
I know, isn't that an amazing and wonderful thing when that happens?
Mm, it really was a wonderful thing.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to reverse a tiny bit. What did you think of printmaking?
Well, I, at that point, you know, I think when you're, it's almost like you're let loose in a sweetie shop because you get all of those wonderful things to explore and play with. And for me, printmaking and painting have always informed each other. So I think a lot of those print techniques that I learned and developed and explored at that stage have really had their kind of impact on my painting, and I still do make prints as well.
Oh, do you?
Well, actually, I literally have just done a. I was invited to do a print commission very recently, just before Christmas, and I've just been working with a master printmaker at Advanced Graphics, and they invited me to come and make the prints. So I literally have just made. To a pair of prints. So, yeah, I do it from time to time, but painting is the thing that I do most consistently.
Yeah. So when you did your postgrad, was it all painting?
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although there was a print department. Well, there wasn't a print department. There was a printmaking room, and again, tutors who practicing artists who actually were wonderful and generous and really did support and help us with things like that. So I had Norman Aykroyd was one of my, he's a Royal Academician, he was one of my printmaking tutors, and he was incredibly supportive, and it was wonderful to actually work alongside him. Like he mm-hmm. would make work and you could see, it's a very kind of generous approach to handing down your knowledge, I think.
Yeah.
As an artist, and the academy is very much set up like that. So there are practicing artists, the Royal Academicians, who actually teach the students, and perhaps wouldn't take, just have wonderful kind of access to to those artists.
And well, and just to watch and learn instead of, you know, trying to figure it out.
Particularly with printmaking, not so much in painting, obviously, but with printmaking, that was a real gift.
Mm-hmm. So, and then did you study any art history? Because your paintings sure look like you studied a lot of art history.
That is a very interesting question. I didn't. But I've been reflecting on this quite a lot recently, because historical painting and sculpture has influenced my practice for many years, and it's definitely, I turn to historical painting as a kind of anchor, a reference point always. And if I travel, I always try to go to museums and collections, and part of that experience for me is to visit paintings and sculptures that maybe I'm familiar with, maybe I'm not, but to actually have that very intimate and personal connection with them in reality. Because we're all so used to seeing images virtually and online, and it's, as we all know, it's a very, very different thing to stand in front of a painting and to properly engage with that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been consistently a very important thing for me as an artist to actually spend time doing that whenever I can. I mean, whenever I go to London, I always go to particular museums and galleries and spend time in them and revisit particular works of art, mm-hmm. and sort of pick up that connection with them. And I think drawing from something directly in that way has been quite fundamental to that being embedded in my practice. So because if you stand in front of a Vermeer or a Velasquez or something, those are the two of my top 10, and you make a drawing directly from that work of art, you certainly, for me, it becomes an emotional connection with that. I've kind of absorbed something of that through the process of making some drawing which relates to it, and I think that's, for me, it's very important. That is a very important part.
Yeah,
of
that's
my
beautiful.
Practice.
That's so beautiful. I totally know what you mean. That, yeah, you've got a instead of just looking and moving on, you've got this sort of intimate knowledge of it, because you've had to draw that nose, or you've had to, you know, consider the shape of the body more, or, you know, than just looking at it and moving on.
Exactly, and it slows down your looking. Drawing, which, I mean, I'll probably repeat myself many times during this conversation, but drawing for me is it's so important. It underpins everything I do, and it's fundamental in terms of making a connection with something. It's about the way that you see it. It is about slowing down your looking and really properly recording something. And that recording may be a few lines of gesture, but in those few lines, you will get something, the essence of something that you have had in that moment, your connection with whatever it was you were looking at. Mm-hmm. And obviously that applies to, you know, when you're working from life in some way, but particularly for me with historical painting, I think, and sculpture.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so poetic and lovely. Makes me want to go draw something, even though I'm not very good
exactly.
at drawing.
Inspire you to start make drawings. But also, I think I've said it quite a lot in my teaching, but also I think sometimes we're kind of all out of ideas. We're all out of, you know, what we should be focusing on. And I think that it's kind of wonderful just to turn to history, to art history, mm-hmm. to be reconnected, because after all, we all have those kind of, you know, sort of our kind of art heritage. We've all made connections with all sorts of art history during our creative journeys, and it's quite important to, you know, check in with them from time to time, and mm-hmm. refer back to artists that have an impact on your practice.
Mm-hmm. I know, I'm kind of, I did study, well, I minored in art history, and there were so many people I knew that were like, oh my gosh, it's so boring. You know, if I ever can't sleep, I just read my art history textbook. And I was like, what are you talking about? I just thought it was the most exciting thing. I just loved it so much. And I think for me, it was, I feel the connections through the stories. This is probably why I have a podcast, to like get the stories from you guys. You know, like I always wanted to know what was going on when they made that painting and like why, and you know, what was happening in their personal life that would make that work exist.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
I find that so interesting. And yeah, there is something really beautiful about, especially when you're a creative person, to like look back and see what came before you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think it's quite interesting to recognize those influences on the development of your work as well and embrace them.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's important. Maybe there's kind of too much made of trying to do something that's really kind of new and original. And in fact, you know, most of the most innovative work comes from a knowledge of that, you know, of art history and the impact that that's had on one's practice,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with, well, when I was in advertising, the big joke was everything had been done in every color. And, you know, and it kind of felt like that sometimes, you know, like you think that you're onto something and then you find out that, oh, actually, this was huge in the 1940s or, you know, like, or even somebody else across the ocean is doing it right now.
Exactly.
And you're like, oh, man. And so I think it's just really important to own whatever it is you're doing.
Exactly.
You know,
and make it yours.
Make it yours,
I think that is much more evident, certainly for me, over the last couple of years or so, engaging with social media, that mm-hmm. obviously you see a lot of visual stuff. But actually, you have to be on your own journey and take... And there are always going to be other artists working along similar lines, but I think if you are true to yourself and you're really on your own path, you just must stick with it and really may claim it as your own.
Yeah.
And you know, there are always going to be people that it's a bit like you have in all sorts of other, like you have in music. There are lots of music genres and there are lots of musicians who have similar kind of influences, and therefore their output is going to be have kind of connections.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the same across all creative practice, really. But I think as long as you're being true to yourself and your ideas that develop come from places that are kind of your own
mm-hmm.
your own sort of ideas and development.
Yeah, that's what I always say. Like you have to kind of own it, and the only difference between your work and anybody else's is you. You know,
exactly.
And so you have to infuse some of you in there, and you certainly have. Okay, I want to know. Okay, so your girls, there are a lot of times mm-hmm. they're girls. Are they from like your version of art history pieces, or do you work with models, or is it from your imagination?
It's an interesting question because. Well, first of all, it's quite interesting you say your girls, because for me, they're not all girls.
I know.
and I think they're becoming increasingly more androgynous, actually, the figures. But I think initially they came from referencing historical painting. And again, that, you know, connects back to what I was saying before. My whole development as my practice comes from drawing and looking and observing and recording, and that stems back to the life room. So the life room for me, it was where my passion for the figure and how that became central to my practice was through those life room experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And I still
was that
have
in your
those.
Undergrad or postgrad?
Both,
yeah,
both.
Yeah.
Actually, it wasn't very popular in my undergrad, so I very fortunately had the model to myself for 2 years, actually, because no one used to. Yes, I did. It was very unpopular to be making work like that. When I went to the Royal Academy schools, the whole first year was there was a very clear structure. You had to go into the life room 2 days a week. I decided to spend the whole year in the life room. For me, that was about, you know, really kind of engaging with the rigor of drawing and looking, and also because of my interest in the figure. And I think, I suppose, if I'm not always referencing something that I have drawn, there's that kind of embedded memory and knowledge of the figure that I have from many, many years of drawing from life.
Right.
So it's a combination of that. It's a combination of sort of connecting with figures in particular paintings, perhaps, and making the drawings in the way that I spoke about before. And it is also from my sort of visual connection with figures that are potentially around. So it's a combination of things now. It's not quite so, you know, black and white.
Yeah.
It's a combination of those things.
Mm-hmm. Well, sort of like what we were saying at the beginning about all of those things layering in, all of your experiences and every, you know,
sure.
It's sort of become this beautiful layering of experience and knowing your own voice and knowing what you're doing, really.
Well, kind of. You know, I still think that it's an ongoing kind of project.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
still,
right.
You still have to. It's about keeping creatively fit. You can't. I've mentioned this before. I just think you have to keep all of those plates spinning. You've got to still be drawing. You've got to still be researching. You've got to still be, you know, all of those elements come in to make that happen. And also you want to continually surprise yourself. You want to do things that you didn't think that you were going to be doing. You know, it's
get bored otherwise.
It's a balancing act.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have been doing it for a very long time.
Spinning those plates. You're a pro now. Well, that's a pretty good segue into what I was going to ask next, because I noticed some of your new work has these beautiful layers of like decorative pattern, almost like lace that you've painted over top of your figures. When did you start doing that and why?
It's really hard to unravel that kind of thing. I think that it came initially from I'd made a drawing from a Petro Longhi painting, a Venetian painting, you know, where they had the Venetian masks.
Oh,
and
yes.
I started to do some research about that. What sort of captivated me initially weren't those Longhi paintings, because I don't particularly like the paintings in their entirety. There were sort of small little passages in those paintings that I was drawn to, and particularly the figures. And there were obviously a number of figures that had these masks on. And I started researching the mask, and I really liked the idea that kind of chimed in with the kind of overarching themes in my work about that transition from childhood to adulthood, and how I wanted to explore that and push that further, and how I could use the mask as a kind of visual device in the painting, both pictorially and in terms of the kind of the overall intention, which was about not quite formed identities or concealing identities. And for me, that pivotal point of transition through puberty, it is about that. It's about that kind of not having quite found your kind of yourself.
Yeah.
You're still being formed. And so this whole idea of the mask, and particularly the Moretto mask, which I researched, it was quite an extraordinary story. Those black masks, you know, that are just sort of on the faces of Venetian paintings, they're held in place by a button in the mouth, which
what?
I thought was, I know, it's quite extraordinary. They're called, I think, Moretto masks. They're held in place by the wearer holding the button in their mouth.
So you can't talk either.
So you can't talk either. So again, for me, that reinforced that whole sort of idea about not finding your voice, not being, you know, having that sort of suppressed. So it really, so the mask element really developed through that chiming in with the ideas that I was trying to explore in the paintings. And then that whole mask idea and the format of that, the graphic shape of the mask and using that as a device in the painting, then sort of started to become more lace-like and then more veil-like. And so that it was a bit like a cocoon, like the young pubescent child sort of breaking out of a cocoon. And so, I mean, I'm sort of unveiling probably quite a lot about the justification of those things, but I think that was my kind of thinking, and it sort of became also connected to things like tattoos and body kind of scarifications. Mm-hmm. And I started researching into sort of tribal body markings. So, you know, it's come from, again, a lot of sort of diverse research, but that it all makes sense. Well, it makes sense to me, and why it's part of the imagery.
Yeah. Oh, that. See, now that is such a good answer. That's what I was. I wondered, because some of their faces are blacked out too.
Sure.
Yeah. And I. Oh. Ooh. I love it all. Okay. There's follow ups to that. As you're talking, I'm like, oh, I gotta ask this, and I gotta ask that. Okay. So. Two things. One. The idea, like, you know, that this mask that you can't talk either with a button in your mouth. Mm-hmm. Does that have anything to do with, like, not only not being able to find yourself, but the whole, I mean, it's very topical at the moment, the whole Me Too thing, and, like, that girls aren't really, you know, you're told to be a good girl growing up. Does it have anything to do with that, or no?
Well, not specifically for me, but now you say that, you see, that's what's interesting about when you're making kind of, you know, when you're exploring visual possibilities through whatever creative medium, all sorts of narratives can be attached to these things, and yeah, it starts to expand. And now you said that, that's made me think about something else that I'm working on in the studio, which is fantastic. So I think it is about just opening up that dialogue and finding ways to talk about what it is I used to find it incredibly difficult to articulate my creative thoughts and ideas. But I think I've become braver over the years, and I think the more that you share those things verbally as well as visually, it helps you to kind of steer and hone your visual language so that it's communicating perhaps more clearly.
Yeah.
And so I think you talked to you saying that is great.
Yeah. Oh, good. Well, yeah, because I find that if you don't, I've just started talking about my work too, just in the last year or so. And sometimes when you're explaining it to someone, even if you don't have the right words, as you explain it, you kind of explain it to yourself.
Exactly.
Because it's just been floating around in your head and you can't put a pin in it. But then when you have to actually say it, you're like, oh, actually, maybe it's from this or that, or, you know, and it leads to the next thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it just opens things up more, because after all, we are, you know, I'm making work to go out into the world to communicate something.
Right.
And I might not always be, well, I'm certainly not always clear about what that is from the outset, but those things sort of accumulate, and then they become a body of work, and that body of work starts to, because very often I think you intuitively and instinctively do something in the studio, and then your thinking catches up with your visual.
Yeah. So, I've talked to so many artists about that, where they're like, it's hindsight, like you don't even really realize. I've told this story a zillion times, so I will keep it short, but I use pink in my work a lot, and I never really knew why, and then it all kind of traces back to my grandmother. But it wasn't until I started talking about it that I was like, oh, that's why I use pink all the time.
Exactly.
And now I can embrace it. And when I use pink, I'm using it intentionally now instead of kind of subconsciously.
Intuitively. Yeah, exactly. And I think again, as your practice evolves and, you know, you've been working at things for a number of years, all of those dots seem to join. And it's incredibly sort of, it's incredibly satisfying that you just can suddenly think, oh, that's why I do that, and that's why that is there. I mean, even during this conversation, you asking me about my parents, I suddenly thought, oh, perhaps that's why, you know, my mother was made a lot of things and there was bits and bobs around all the time, and maybe that is why I'm quiet, you know. I mean, it's not the only reason, of course, but it's part of your kind of journey, isn't
yeah,
it? And I think that's kind of wonderful.
Yeah, it's this really neat little story that makes up who you are, and you kind of don't realize it until you can look, turn around and look back. You know, when you're
Absolutely.
In it, it's so hard to see clearly, but when you can turn around and look back, it's like, oh, okay, that makes sense now.
Exactly.
Okay, so then my other tangent that I had when you were talking about that is, was there something about, see, I'm going to get super deep now. Was there something about your personal transition from, like, you know, tween to teen to, like, to womanhood that, or do you have daughters, or, like, what is it about that time?
That is a very interesting tangent. Not for me personally. I did not really have any major issues, as far as I was aware of, that transition. But I am a mother. I have two sons, in fact, which is contrary to what most people think.
Would guess,
they
yeah.
do probably think I have girls. But I do think my work has always been informed by the things around me, and it certainly has been informed by my children and my journey as a mother. And I think that you cannot detach yourself from those things that are happening alongside your creative life.
No, you can't.
Well, I can't. I personally can't. So I definitely think that my experience as a mother has informed, and also, you know, seeing my friends going through similar things with their own children and observing, and it definitely has kind of informed what is happening in the world. I think it's fascinating. I think it's fascinating to be close witness to the sort of development of childhood.
Yeah.
I think it's an extraordinary journey. It's tricky at times being a parent, witnessing that, but as a kind of an artist, you know, looking at those things, which I sometimes do with a bit of perspective, you know, it's quite an extraordinary thing. So,
I know when my son was little, I used to do sort of mixed media pieces when he was asleep. So I did a whole series called While You Slept, because this is when I would do it. And I would just document everything that we had done that day. Like, you know, he'd seen his first chipmunk and lost his mind. Or, you know, I tried to be domestic and bake cookies and burnt them to a crisp. And so I would just, you know, and I would work all of that in because it was my reality.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's really important to somehow kind of mark those moments in particular ways.
Yeah.
I mean, having said that, I mean, my paintings might at certain points have kind of had some visual connection to my own children, but not really. They've never been portraits. They've never really, they're sort of loosely informed, I would say.
Yeah. Have you ever had the urge to do portraits of them, or is that just not where you want it?
No, I mean, I mean, very early on, I was invited to make lots of kind of portrait commissions. I did a couple, and they were sort of disastrous, really. And I realised that I didn't want those constraints on myself as an artist. It wasn't for me. And yet, I still really, even now, still very much enjoy that kind of having passages in the work that are rendered in more representational way. I mean, that's something that I've revisited in recent years, probably in the paintings that you're talking about, that there are kind of passages in those paintings that are more highly rendered, more representational, and that actually connects back to sort of work that I made 25 years ago when I was a student at the Royal Academy. You know, that there were paintings that have that kind of academic rigor.
Right.
But I just feel like I can have everything at the moment. I have a bit of that and a bit of something else. So
they're just all so beautiful. And okay, but then this, so how old are your boys now?
They're quite old now. I've got a 24-year-old and an 18-year-old.
Okay. And then so you have been an artist and raised these boys and also a teacher, back to Charlotte Keats. So where were you
back to lovely Charlotte.
Yeah, were you teaching full time or were you just teaching one?
No. I was very fortunate. We moved when our first son was three from London to Cornwall, which is in the southwest of England. It's a very beautiful part of the country. And we moved down, and both my husband and I, he's an artist as well, we both got teaching at Falmouth University. Well, it was then Falmouth College of Art. And it was part-time. And I have always tried to get the balance right. So we were very fortunate to have some part-time teaching. And I managed to maintain a day a week mostly. Sometimes I had to do a couple of days a week, but mostly a day a week over a very long period of time. I taught there for 18 years.
Wow.
And it was wonderful. And I really, it was wonderful to be connected to a place like that, moving from London. It's 350 miles or so from London.
Yeah.
So it was a big move. And then to be connected to an art institution like Falmouth, which is an extraordinary art school.
That's what I've heard, still,
yeah, it really is. And known for painting, actually, as well.
Were you teaching painting or were you teaching drawing?
I was teaching everything. I mean, I suppose it's set up in a very different way. I was as a part-time lecturer, I was given a group of students, and for most of my time teaching there, I just had a small group of students who I saw through from the first year to the third year.
Oh.
So you have regular contact with a very small group of students, and everyone is sort of appropriately paired off with the right type of tutor, and you support these young artists on their journey, and it was a real privilege. It was a real privilege, and when it worked well, it was wonderful.
Yeah, when those matches were right.
Yeah. Or even when they weren't, it was challenging and interesting.
I just take my hat off to teachers. I've taught a tiny little bit, and my gosh, it's so rewarding, but so exhausting.
I tried to keep it to one day a week, because otherwise I wouldn't have had the sanity for my own work.
No, your own work, and then you had two little boys. Like you know, they grew up through those 18 years.
Sure, but then I have a very supportive artist husband who knows the score, and we literally shared duties.
Yeah.
So it was, thankfully it worked. But but I do think it was wonderful to have the opportunity to actually engage with the students anyway. But I think I had a lot of generous tutors in my art education, and I think if you've had that, you want to somehow give that back.
Mm-hmm.
And actually it was wonderful to have that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, and then in my situation, I had terrible teachers. generally speaking, I had one who I absolutely loved, who was like made a huge impact on my life. But generally speaking, it was a really bad experience. And so when I have taught, I've wanted to give everything because I didn't get it. Do you know what I mean? Same thing. Like, I just go in there and I want to just, like, be able to give them the support and give them the guidance that I felt like I only got from that one teacher kind of near the end of my degree. And it's so funny that either experience leads to wanting to give more.
Yeah. I mean, it's a wonderful position. It's a privileged position to be in, to actually engage with young artists. And for me, it actually really did, kept me on my toes. I had to kind of do lots of research, and also I think because I didn't really ever feel that it was very much like teaching, it's like just going to have a kind of studio chat with someone who you get to know over a period of time. And actually, it's just about talking to a younger artist who's still dealing with all the same things as I was dealing with, but just a bit earlier on in their journey.
Well, the teacher that I had that I loved, her name is Elspeth Pratt. She's a sculptor from Canada, and I'm writing a book right now about women artists, and mm-hmm. I I mean, she didn't remember me. I'm, you know, 25 years ago, and my name has changed, and, you know, I mean, she saw zillions of kids. And I reached out to her and said, can I, you know, remember me? And I would love to have you in this book. And she did it. And,
oh, that's wonderful.
And getting her interview back. And then I rewrote it in my own words. And but, like, again, like, she was, I asked, you know, if you have any advice, what would it be? And she said, I learned a long time ago that it's better to not give advice, but to basically help to listen to who's sitting in front of you and help them along their own path. Mm. And I was like, see, that is why you were my favorite teacher.
Yep.
So it sounds like you're the same.
I don't know whether I was everyone's favorite teacher because I used to give my opinions.
No, well, Charlotte was just so, had so many good things to say about you. And I already loved your work. I've written about you a few times. And then it's just so funny when you find out these small world, you know, I've had Charlotte on the podcast and then she's like, hey, Lisa was actually my teacher. And I was like,
yes, I know. It's really, I find that the well, within the world of art, it does keep getting smaller and smaller.
Does.
And it's wonderful, those connections. I think it's very affirming.
Well, yeah, like I'm on the other side of the world from you guys, you know, and then to know that you were both there. Well, let me throw this out. Do you know Susanna Bauer?
I should, shouldn't I?
She's in Cornwall. Yep, she lives in Cornwall, and she embroiders on leaves, like she... It's insane. She does like...
Did you do a podcast
yes.
with her?
Yep.
I don't know her, but I do know the work. I'm really bad at remembering names.
Well, there you go. She lives in Cornwall. You guys can go have
work.
A coffee.
Yeah.
Or a cup of tea, maybe. But yeah, she's lovely. She's actually German, but she moved to Cornwall from London. She was living in London. Same sort of thing. Had her son and moved to Cornwall and just... loves it there, loves it. And I've never been. I lived in London for a while, but I never went to Cornwall, so now I have to come and see you guys.
You do have to come and see us.
Yeah.
It is a wonderful place, full of lots of amazing artists.
That's what I've heard. I've got to get myself there. Maybe I can rope my way into going to the university to do a talk or something.
Now, there is something. I would certainly put your name forward for that.
Okay, I will come. That would be amazing. Okay, so... Well, your Skype photo that I'm looking at this entire time has a Pulse Miami sign behind your head. So you are on fire. So you went to Pulse Miami this last year, and then you were at Context in New York.
Yes.
So you are a busy lady. How did you go to New York for that?
I did. Yes. My kind of mantra now is, you know, if there's somewhere to go with your art, just do it.
Same here. Me too.
Why wouldn't I? I mean, I'm very fortunate to be working with a great gallery at the moment, Coates and Scarry. And they, since I've been working with them, they have much more of an international sort of program. And that has opened things up for me a lot. And, you know, they've given me opportunities to show the work in Hong Kong and, as you say, in New York and Miami, in Basel. And it's been fantastic because it's something that I've wanted for a long time to have that kind of reach. And it's just been a very, very nice growing relationship with them. So that's how those sorts of things have come about.
How long have you been with them?
Probably about, well, since about 2015.
Okay.
So not that long.
Yeah.
14, 15, I think.
And you know,
I think my first solo show with them was in 2015, end of 2015.
Wow, that is so, it's so exciting. I'm the same way. If there's a reason to go somewhere, I'm going. And then are your paintings, are some of them huge? What's your scale?
I do work on a range of scales. Everything from very small scale up to kind of 8 foot. I don't know whether you, in sort of like 2 point something meters.
I saw a picture somewhere of you, like, I don't know if it was on Instagram or maybe it's on the front of your site where you're doing the lacy stuff and it was huge. And I had no idea that some of the work was that big.
Yeah, I think that is the very misleading thing, again, about seeing things, you know,
online.
On screen.
Yeah.
Because you just don't get that sense of scale, and you also don't get the sense of the surface of work. And particularly for me, in my work, I've always tried to get that kind of balance of the impact of an image and the painterly kind of range within yeah. that. So, you know, there's a kind of initial impact of something, but scale and format and also that the kind of surface as well. So I always want whoever's looking at my work to get something even more from looking at something close up. So it's an extra kind of reward to have that sort of luscious surface or some kind of detail or surface. And I think all the sort of painters that I really admire and always want to keep revisiting work of, they give me that extra thing when I have my nose you know, practically up against the painting.
So yeah, it's like icing that you kind of want to touch.
But that's really important. I think for me that is really important, that a painting delivers on all those levels, from afar, from up, you know, yeah. from fairly close up, but also, you know, that the surface is very rewarding.
Mm-hmm. So, oh, I love that.
Yeah, but it scale's really important, I think.
Yeah, I need to stand in front of one of yours. It is hard. Like, I love, you know, what I do and showing the work online, but I, you know, then I went to Art Miami last year and just standing, you know, I've told this story so many times that when I walked through there and every corner I turned, I was like, oh my God, I love that. Oh my God. And it was like all these people that I've written about who I've never seen in person. And to stand in front of it, I mean, I already loved it and wrote about it, but then to stand in front of it in person is completely different. And I wish I'd been there last year to stand in front of yours.
Oh, well, yeah, we have to try and make it happen somewhere
yeah,
else.
Yeah, one day, somewhere, Hong Kong, who knows. I know, you know, when you're talking about standing in front of, like, going to museums and standing in front of these things, I've almost cried sometimes when you stand in front of something that you've studied in a book or you've seen, you know, online or whatever, and then you actually stand there and you realize that these masters, like, their paintbrush made that mark that you're now standing in front of. Like, there's something that gives me just chills about that, you know, to know that their hand was right there.
I know, it's extraordinary. I mean, I too have wept many a time in front of paintings that, and it's quite interesting, I think they're always paintings, key paintings that stay with you your mm-hmm. whole journey. And then when you, and they change every time you see them. Mm-hmm. You know, seeing a couple of years ago, and I, you know, that painting I know intimately, and you know, I've seen it in reality many times, and then you kind of revisit, and it's either shrunk or it's grown, or you've seen something else in it that you hadn't seen before, and it's an extraordinary experience.
Mm-hmm. I went to Monet's house in Giverny. I've been there 4 times now.
Wow.
And I remember, like, you can go into the house and walk all through the gardens, which is just surreal, you know, to actually see the lily ponds and whatever. But then in his house, everything is roped off, right? So you can look into the kitchen, but you can't, you know, I don't think you're allowed to sit at the table, you know. But there was the door that went out to the garden, and you weren't supposed to go out that door, but you went a different way. But when no security guards were looking, I didn't go through because I thought, oh, I'm really going to get busted then. But I touched the door handle. I held the door handle because I thought how many times he turned that door handle to go out into the garden, you know, and I just wanted to, like, put my hand there, you know. And I went out in the garden. I sat in the garden and I was drawing. That was about 22 at the time, and just cried in the garden. It was so
amazing. Oh, that's such a wonderful story.
Yeah,
that really is. And I do think it is that. It's about that connection, isn't it?
Yeah.
Something and someone that you feel had you know, has a connection with your own creativity.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Well, and people like that, like Monet, I mean, everything is on a postcard and an umbrella and a mug and whatever. And you know, Warhol, whatever. They almost become pretend, like they weren't, you know, they're just so part of our history. It's like they're not even really real or whatever. But then to go to their house or to see something that was really, you know, or to stand in front of the piece that they really made is a very emotional
Absolutely.
Experience.
It really is.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, however kind of diluted our experience with someone like Monet is, as you say, when you stand in front of something, you just think, he made these paintings, like, you know, 100 years ago.
Yeah.
How extraordinary.
Yeah, I know. I get it. And now I'll have to come and stand in front of yours and have that same, the same
well,
experience.
Well, I hope so. I hope so at some point.
And so you've had all these amazing things happening. Is there things coming up that people should know about? Do you have any shows?
Well, yes, I do. And in fact, well, it may be closer to home. I have got a show scheduled in New York in November.
Ooh.
At Faction Arts, which is a new sort of gallery space in connection with Coates and Scarry. They're opening this new space in Harlem.
Yeah, they just emailed me. Yeah, that's crazy. Okay, small world again, yep.
Very small world. Yeah. So I'm due to have a show there early November. So perhaps it might be an excuse for you to come to New York and stand in front of one of my new paintings.
Well, my new book is released in the fall. I don't know the date yet, but sometime in the fall. And I'm doing like a big book tour and New York is on it. So wouldn't that be crazy
that
if that lined up?
That would be so good. Well, mine is kind of, I mean, it's not fixed dates, but I know it's going to be opening in early November.
Okay,
so
well,
if there's
in
any
the
way
universe.
We can coordinate, that would be wonderful.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. It's in the universe now. I'll land there on November 2nd. Okay.
Yeah, and then I'm also working on a very exciting project, which I can't really say too much about, but with...
just dangle the carrot for us.
Yeah, just dangle. No, I've been wanting to do a collaborative project for a long time, and many years ago, I was invited to work with the Royal Shakespeare Company by the artistic director there called Tom Piper, and he and I have... remained friends over the years since that had happened, and that was an extraordinary experience as well. So I was artist in residence for the history cycle at Royal Shakespeare Company for a couple of years, kind of not really in residence, sort of partially in residence. So we worked together, and he and I are working on a collaborative project, which, so that's exciting. Which I can't really say too much about, but...
is there an end date? Is there an end date for that collaborative project?
That's going to be developed over throughout this year, and it will be hopefully launched next year.
Okay.
So that's an exciting thing and very much out of my comfort zone, which I think is really important, she says bravely, to kind of challenge yourself.
That's right. You can give your teacher advice to yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. So I have got a lot on. So, and it's very exciting.
That's so exciting.
That's great.
Well, we can celebrate the excitement with the not so speedy speed round.
Okay.
Are you familiar with the not so speedy speed round?
Yes, I have heard your podcast.
Okay.
So I'm just wondering what you're going to ask me.
Well, I'm setting you up the first one. Are you ready?
Okay.
Do you eat Marmite?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Not very often, I have to say, but I do like it, yeah.
All right. I like Vegemite. I think the time I had Marmite, I was staying with somebody in London, and they applied it like tar.
No.
It was
liberally.
Yes, it was
liberally.
It was too much. I should try it again. Okay. This, you might have to think. If you need to think, we will cut out the long pause.
Okay.
The best field trip you ever took in school, like elementary school, high school,
I will have to think. Okay, actually, this is the first thing that came to mind. The best field trip. Oh, you're saying at school though, rather than at university, aren't you?
Well, no, whatever. If it came, whatever came to mind.
Okay, I was going to say I went on a trip to the Prado in Madrid.
Mm.
No, maybe not that one then. I went to a. Okay, this has come to mind. When I was at school, I went to a forest, a pine eaten, which was not too far from where I went to school, and it was extraordinary. The scale of the trees was very memorable.
We are doing a really good job of linking a whole bunch of things together here.
Yep.
Okay, let's see if this links to anything. Favorite dessert?
Ice cream.
Do you have a favorite go-to flavor?
Chocolate chip.
Oh, yeah, that's my son's
favorite.
No,
mint chocolate chip.
Okay, yeah. He would not go for that. He's all about the chocolate chip cookie dough. Have you ever had that?
Oh, no, no, I don't like that.
Oh, you don't like the chunks of stuff? No. All right, well.
No, I like mint choc chip or something kind of nutty.
Okay. this will be interesting. Would you rather go, this is the last one, would you rather go back in time or into the future?
That is really back in time.
That's what I kind back of thought time. You would say.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I went to Venice in May, to the Venice Biennale.
Yes, I was there in August.
Oh, and I just thought, I would really, there was, because you feel like you are absolutely immersed in that sense of history, because it is so visually unspoiled.
Yeah.
You feel like you can turn a corner and you have set back in time.
Yeah.
And actually, I do think that would be quite extraordinary. Just to, just to kind of visually kind of take it all in.
Yeah, yeah. I know. Yeah. Venice was, there's something, it's the weirdest place. It's just like.
It is.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary and weird. Yeah. And
had you been there before?
I had. I've actually, strangely enough, I hadn't been there for many years, and then I went twice in the space of a few months. So,
Did you don't tell me you had work in the beginning.
No, I didn't. But, you know,
one day.
Here's hoping one
yeah.
day.
Me too. That was like my dream now, and I've even sent various emails, but alas, no responses. But I was like, how does one, like, I would love to be the curator for the Canadian Pavilion. How does
Wouldn't
one put their
good?
Name forward for that? I don't think you do. I think it gets decided.
You get a point.
I think so, and I don't think they're going to pick a blogger. But, you know, and yeah, it's just, it was surreal. Like, not only all of the art, but then, yeah, just walking around, you know, walking over these bridges that are so old that, you know, people have walked over for hundreds and hundreds of years.
It's
especially being from Canada, where nothing is that old, you know, to go there was just crazy for me.
It is an extraordinary place to visit, I have to say. Very inspiring.
Well, that was all my questions.
Oh,
see, that hour flew by.
I know. It really did. Actually, has it been an hour?
Yeah.
Oh, it's been a bit over an hour.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
That's fantastic.
Yeah, now you can go have a cocktail.
I can so have something. I'm going to need something.
Well, you're allowed to, because it's your time of day for that. It's 10:30 in the morning for me,
yeah,
so I probably shouldn't
that,
have one yet.
No,
maybe like wait till noon or something. Yeah.
Oh.
Well, thank you so much. This was so much fun to hear all of your stuff and to get the inside scoop, and now I get to write another giant post.
Oh, thank you so much. I was really touched that you invited me to have this conversation. And, you know, thank you, Charlotte, for kind of connecting the dots. But, no, I've listened to a lot of the podcasts and, you know, I feel very honoured to be in that list. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I really hope, Danielle, that we do get to meet face-to-face at some point.
Me too. I feel like we will.
Yeah, I hope so.
I totally feel like we will. Yeah, and then just imagine the things we'll talk about. Like, gosh, if we went to a cafe
I was just going to say we'd have to kind of put a timer on ourselves, wouldn't we?
Yeah, I know. They'd be like, "Can you guys get out of here, please? You've been here for 8 hours. It's like, one more mint chip for everybody."
I've been known to talk that long. I am a
Me
talker,
too.
But
Me too.
No. but that's been lovely to share that with you. And great to kind of encourage me to think about those things. So
I'm curious now to see, like, that was an accident. I didn't mean to plant any seeds, but now I'm kind of curious to see where that might go. Mm-hmm.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Well, we'll hopefully keep in touch, you know, through all sorts of means, social media and otherwise, and let's hope we do get the chance to have a meet up at some point before too long. But I'll let you know. Obviously, if Coates and Scary have reached out to you, then you're on their mailing, so you'll find out exactly when my
show is
going to be in New
York. Yeah, that's right. I've got all the info, so that's fantastic.
That's great.
Thank you again so much for taking the time, and yeah, I will keep an eye out on social media, and we will meet up. I promise it.
Yeah.
I know it.
Oh, that's great, Danielle. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. You have a lovely evening.
Take care.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye for now.
Bye. Well, I could have talked to her for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. So, my goal for 2018, stand in front of one of Lisa's large-scale works, preferably somewhere warm like Miami. Everything that Lisa and I talked about is up on my site right now at thejealouscurator.com, so pop over there and have a look. I made sure to include a few photos showing scale and detail. Granted, it's not the same as standing in front of it, but I did the best I could with JPEGs and the online world. Thank you so much to Lisa for being so open and generous with her stories and insights. Thank you so much to Saatchi Art for supporting yet another episode. And big thank yous to you for listening. There will be more Art for Your Ear next weekend. See you then.